Welcome, everyone, to the Goldster podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all characters and styles and their enriching stories about their lives, their victories, their failures, their dreams, and, of course, their books. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the duration, and today we're exploring writing fiction. Please enjoy, and to find out more, check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. And without further ado, let us begin. Hi, everybody. I can see most of you through the glare of the spotlights here, but welcome to our first ever fully fledged live inside story from here at the fabulous Riverstone Cinema on the banks of the Thames in London. And I just have to say, from a personal point, it's so good to see human beings in the flesh. Soon, I hope to hear your voices and your curiosity, your comments, your criticism, maybe, of our very, very special guest. And also welcome to all of you who are going to be joining us online and in the future on the Goldster podcast and catch up. Now, some of you might have had the luck, or I should say skill, to have met our guests on our author-to-author special a few weeks back, and he was so good that I couldn't resist asking him to join us live as our guinea pig for our inaugural author interview show. My guest is a multi-million copy bestseller, and some of those books here are on sale through Nomad Books at Riverstone. Outside, as soon as we finish, go out and buy them all up, because they are going to be unique collector copies. In Evan Smoke, he has created one of the most intriguing characters of modern fiction. How is that done? How do you create a character like Evan Smoke, James Bond, Jack Reacher? And like all characters, this one is steeped in childhood experiences and how they mold all of us when we were children. Orphan X is, though, the type of person that you want on your side when things get tough, when you walk out onto the riverbanks in Fulham, and one who lives by 10 commandments. I have them here, and we're going to go through them one by one. And we also want to know from all our viewers whether you have a code that you live by and your own 10 commandments. And amid his creative edge-of-the-seat tension, my guest is also a seeker of common ground in his spare time. As his hobby, if we can call him that, he works on bridging divides in our polarized political climate. What more can I say except welcome Greg Hurwitz to Goldster Inside Story. Good to see you. You look like quite a tough guy.
Do I?
Yeah. I mean, are you?
Is this only in relation because I'm American, or
no, is there? You write about tough guys, and your picture, tough guys.
My picture's pretty glary, isn't it?
Yeah. And you look fit too.
Well, thank you. This interview's off to a terrific start.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I think what I'm trying to get at is, what is the difference between a British hero or an English hero and an American hero, would you say?
I think British heroes use better grammar.
And?
American heroes tend to be renegades and loners and outsiders. There's something in the individualism of the American landscape, right? Less bound to tradition, the unfolding of manifest destiny, right? So as America moved across from settlement on the East Coast to the West Coast, right? Yeah. There's the Turner thesis that the rugged edge of individualism was always the frontier. I think that's part of why I grew up in California. And I think part of why we're considered a little hippy dippy is, like, at a certain point, there's no more expansion. So they had to go internal. That's why we have all the cults, right? Like, there's only so much expansion that one can have. And then we hit the Pacific Ocean and ran out of places to go.
Right.
But I do think that there's something in the loner and the individual. America has the predominant value is on freedom above all else. I mean,
and when you were growing up reading, presumably thrillers like you write now and other books like that, did you get a definition of what a British hero would be? A George Smiley character, for example, which is not what you just said.
Well, we love George Smiley, of course. But I mean, for me, the archetype was James Bond.
Right.
Of course. Okay. I mean, I grew up, watching all those movies. It was every form of an education.
Yes, I think James. But the
I mean, that's. I was going to ask this later on, but I'm going to ask it now. Heroes have names like James Bond, Jack Reacher, this sort of thing. Your hero, Evan Smoke, where did you get that name?
So there's two places where I get my names for characters when they don't just kind of alight on my brain. One of them is from members of the spec ops communities. They tend to be unimprovably named, right? So I may have a friend whose last name...
Can you explain that community?
Navy SEALs, you know, former CIA, Army Rangers. I mean, they have last names like Wingate, right? There's like, there's these names you just can't get any better. And the other one is American baseball players, right? So for instance, my favorite catcher of all time for the San Francisco Giants is Buster Posey. If you name your child Buster Posey, you've pretty much sealed his vocational fate, right? He's going to be probably starting in major leagues. And so there is a ball player in America whose last name is Smoke, spelled S-M-O-A-K. Yeah. And it's a name that I love because if I spelled it properly, let's just say, then the name feels it's too precious, right? But to spell it the way that the surname goes,
you remember it.
Yeah. That's right. And so I took that, and then Evan, look, naming a main character, it's like when you're naming your child, right? Yes. You have to go down the list with your spouse, and you know, I suggest a name, and my wife would say, "Well, no, I dated a guy named that in high school, and that's no good at all," right? And then somebody else was like nattering, you know, pain, and you can't choose that name, and so you have to arrive at a name that you can really live with, that all the associations are good. And Evan for me was just one of those names that it struck me.
It didn't worry you that it wasn't Ed Smith or something that people would, you know, that would be on a billboard. People do remember it, do they?
Yeah, I think Evan Smoke is quite billboard worthy.
You think it is?
Billboard? I do.
Okay. I was looking at The Last Orphan, which you're over here to promote that.
Yes.
This is your, what number book?
The eighth in the Orphan X series.
The eighth book. And I noticed in there, because I always like to know who's dedicating books to whom and why. And you usually find a wife or a father or a mother or an agent possibly. But you dedicated this book to your British editor.
I did, indeed.
And that's a bit of a rarity, isn't it?
I suppose it is. Look, we go back 10 books. We have a very good relationship, both creatively and personally. And publishing's a difficult business. You know, there's been a lot of changes. There's been a lot that's moved. And so in a lot of ways, you know, I have an advocate in the UK in the form of this editor, my editor and publisher, Roland White, who's here. Hello,
Where
Roland.
Is he? Well, let's give him a right round of applause. Yeah. Let's give Roland White a round of applause.
But, you know, it takes a lot. It's funny because I also work in screenplays and TV, of course, which are more overtly and obviously collaborative. But without a proper publishing house, without a proper champion somewhere, there's just too many cracks to slip through. And so in Roland, I've been with him my last 10 books here. And I've just had a champion both creatively and strategically and tactically, and it's just unimprovable if you get that right. And then that tends to permeate throughout the culture. And so I'm with Penguin, Random House, Michael Joseph, and it's just a spectacular team there. Everyone's hardworking and diligent and cheery, and everyone also is fairly skilled at drinking gin. Like, there's a lot of good requirements that one wants in a British publishing house.
It's not vodka. Evan's a vodka.
Evan's guys. Vodka, yeah. But, you know, when in Rome.
but to go on from that, the British and the American, we have this so-called special relationship that probably in Britain we think is more special than is in America. And then we've just talked about the difference between the American hero and the British hero. How does it work with your editor in the US and your editor here in getting the book together?
Well, I consider, you know, look, like most Americans, I really only speak one language. You know, that's the joke, right? What do you call somebody who speaks two languages is bilingual and three is trilingual, and one language you call them American. I speak passable Spanish because I'm from California.
Yeah.
So my two real primary editors and relationships with houses are US and UK, because I speak both American and English with some proficiency. And so those are the manuscripts when they go out, go to both at the same time. And so, I mean, look, I lived in England. I came out, I did a master's here. I love this country in a lot of ways. I feel more at home here than anywhere than in my home. And so I love being here. I love coming over here. And so, you know, in a way, it's pretty great because I have two sets of eyes. I have two sets of aesthetics. I have two very trusted editors who can weigh in on a book. And that's one of the rules creatively. You know, it's very hard to, I talk to young writers a lot and I always say, be very careful who you choose to take notes from. But if you trust somebody, then you have to really listen.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, and listening means sometimes the note won't make sense. And part of your job is to excavate the editorial anxiety that's underlying the note that is given. It doesn't mean take it literally, but so I'm in a pretty a position of great advantage to have a team of experts around, particularly crime fiction and thrillers, weighing in on my work.
I want you to describe to us in a nutshell the Orphan X character in a moment, to sort of ground it and then see how that's developed over the 8 books with those editors. But I just want to say to everybody here and listening or with us online, if you've got any questions you want to ask at all, just put them in the chat, or you'll have notes next to you. So scribble down something, and Stephanie, the wonderful Stephanie, our chief operating officer, will run them over to me. I won't let Greg see them. And then we will feed them into our conversation. We've also going to go over Evan Smoke's 10 Commandments. And I compared them to the 10 Commandments that I was taught at school to see if I could find common ground. And if any of you have codes that you live by or your own 10 Commandments, let us know about them so that we can discuss that sort of human moral code that you put in your character when we discussed this before. But give us this nutshell of who your main character is.
So Evan Smoke was raised motherless and fatherless and through the foster home system in East Baltimore, which is not an easy place to grow up. And at the age of 12, he was the smallest, scrawniest kid in the foster home. And he was chosen out by a CIA handler named Jack Johns for a special program, a black program that's buried so deep in the DOD that most members of the American government don't even know what it is. It's a full deniability, full black program. And Jack chose him. Usually they chose the biggest kid or the strongest kid. And he chose Evan because, as he says, you know, watching you got knocked down the most times, but it also means you got up the most times. And one of the things he tells Evan very early on is, you know what it feels like to be vulnerable, and don't ever forget that. Like, you carry that within you. And so as he trained Evan, so he kind of pulled him out, you know, took him out of circulation, trained him in isolation with different subject matter experts, psyops, drown proofing, hand-to-hand combat, knife fighting, and also culture and etiquette, because he has to learn how to blend in. One of the things that Jack tells him very early on when he's still a young kid is, he says, the hard part is not going to be making you a killer. The hard part is keeping you human. And in a way, Jack should have treated him like the expendable weapon that he's designed to be. But Jack actually really loved this kid. And in a way, that gave him, that's his Achilles heel. It's a lot easier to be a true believer, right? It's a lot easier to have your black and white view of the world and just stick to it and execute it. And so those two things put Evan on a collision course. And at a certain point, his own moral compass lost its alignment with the orphan program, and he fled and went kind of off the radar. He's pursued by the very government that created him. And he has an encrypted phone number, 1-855-2-NOWHERE. One of his operational aliases was the Nowhere Man.
Nobody try calling that now, because
I'm not sure if you can call it from England, but in the US you can call it and he
plus
will answer.
One, I think we, yeah. then we go down and see what happens.
And so basically he becomes a pro bono assassin for people who are in desperate straits, who are being terrorized by a person or a group of people and have nowhere to turn. And so he has figured out a way to use his extensive skill set and his inexhaustible resources to apply them to missions that are aligned with that task that Jack gave him, which is to remain human. And one of the ways I think about him a lot as the series begins, and so the series begins after a lot of that backstory, it's filled in bits and pieces along the way. But Evan, in a lot of ways, it's almost like he wakes up one day and realizes that he's Pinocchio, but he wants to be a real boy. He wants to learn how to speak the strange language of intimacy that he was never taught. He wants to live in the real world where other people live, but he can't. It's like he's got his face up to the glass and he's looking in at all these people being terrorized in different ways. And while he can't ever have that life, what he can do is he's a wolf who can hunt the other wolves. And so he can preserve for other people the very kind of life that he himself can never have.
And give us the top line, that character that you so brilliantly done, the top line about the vodka and Iceland in Last Orphan to make us want to love that book.
So Orphan X, Evan Smoke, drinks the world's finest vodkas. And part of that is that vodka is one of the purest liquids on earth. And he borders on OCD, right? So drinking this is like a purification ritual for him almost. What's amazing is if I write about a vodka, sometimes their sales go up. And so I get sent these beautiful vodkas from around the world. I think next time I'm going to write about a Bentley. But part of it is
set in Riverstone, and
that's true. I want an apartment here. So I'm going to get greedy and I'm going to just turn to full materialism in my brand promotion. But so he drinks these vodkas. He drinks the world's greatest vodkas, and he'll have like one drink. He's very, very meticulous about everything in his life. And so when I was thinking about where to set him at the opening of The Last Orphan, we find him on atop a glacier in Iceland in a pop-up bar. He's drinking Reka, which is one of the great vodkas, Icelandic vodkas. And actually, if people purchase the hardcover here in the hardback in the UK, you can win. You have a chance to win a trip to Iceland and to visit the distillery. So
and the vodka distillery, and the other element you have, I'm not sure if it's in all the books, is that at the beginning he faces down some bad guys. You might not actually see him knock them out, but you know that he's sort of got rid of some bad stuff that you might meet anywhere on the street.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. He's a pretty effective intervener on behalf.
Can you do all that stuff?
Not well.
No.
I mean, yeah, I think I've shot, all the guns that he has been on, from, Benelli combat shotguns to custom 1911s. I snuck on a demolition ranges with Navy SEALs and blown up cars. I do a lot of firsthand research. And so I did train in mixed martial arts fighting for a while before I started the Orphan X series, which makes me sound impressive unless you saw me training, because it was mostly a continuous process of introducing my face to the training mat. But part of why I do that is if I experience something, then I can really place the reader there in a way that is, I want them to have a front row seat to the action. And so
So give us an idea. I mean, we can all look up what it's like or what happens when you fire a Glock or an AK-47 or something like that. But give us an idea of what you thought it would be like. And then you go into the range and you fire it and you say, oh, actually, it does this.
I mean, it depends on the weapon. I mean, some of them have an unbelievable kick that you're not anticipating, right? Part of it is how you anticipate recoil, which will cause you to group your shots, usually high and right. Depends what handed you are. I mean, so those are the things that we're looking for. When I was doing the mixed martial arts training, I was choked out at one point, like in a chokehold, and experiencing that, like, pain has different qualities, right? And panic has different qualities. And so, I mean, enough of us have been either punched in the face or have got hit by a ball in the face or an elbow accidentally. And face pain has its own distinct quality, right? It feels different from when you're hitting another part of your body. And likewise, getting choked out, there's a particular kind of claustrophobia that ensues, that for me to experience it, I could write about it in a way that then I will avoid cliches. If I'm only writing about it from the perspective of having read it in books or seen it in movies, then I'm sort of I'm regurgitating to some sense, like secondhand impressions of what it is. But if I go there and put my, carotid arteries on the line.
No, thank you.
Yeah.
Not here anyway.
Okay. No. But then I can get something that's like one of those telling details where a reader feels like they're right there. Right. And it's part of my job is to carry the reader across the suspension of disbelief into this other world of suspense, that you believe that what I'm writing is happening.
Could I then take you from the shooting range to the thought of vulnerability and dehumanization that comes with your character at childhood? Did you have any of that whatsoever? You know, we all have our childhood experiences. Did you have anything that matched that?
Yeah, it's so funny with writing. The best writing for me comes from my gut. I think in story, I think in scenes, I think in characters. I don't think, I want to write a book around the theme of, loss, or I don't think from the top down, the abstract down, it's got to come from kind of from my guts, really. But in hindsight, it's so amusing. Like I look back on it and it's like, oh, when I was 12, I was the smallest kid in my school. You know, I was from a very liberal Jewish background. I went to co-ed schools all the way growing up. And my parents sent me to a Jesuit Catholic, obviously Catholic, all boys high school. And I was the smallest kid out of 1,200 boys.
So you were out of culture and out of
everything.
Out of everything.
And it was such a kind of bracing experience to be.
Vulnerable? You felt vulnerable.
How deep are we going to go here, Humphrey?
We're going to go as deep as you want.
All right. Yeah. I mean, it was terrifying. First of all, I liked girls. I mean, in both senses of the word. I mean, I had a lot of girl friends also, and I was in this foreign environment completely, culturally and religiously and everything about it. And it was a big sports kind of powerhouse. And so I hadn't yet grown into myself. And so all that I had was grit and discipline. I mean, I knew that when I started. I thought if I work as hard as I conceivably can and choose, you know, the most dangerous sport available that they won't cut me from, which was pole vaulting. I joined track and field, didn't have cuts. And I went out to pole vault. I was so small my freshman year, I couldn't even bend the pole. But I remember thinking, you know, all that I have is that I can work harder than anybody else. That's the only thing that I can do right now because I can't grow quicker and I can't get bigger. And so that obviously you look back on Orphan X and it's like, clearly I'm writing about that. Right. But my lizard brain wasn't talking to my prefrontal cortex. Right. And I'm writing out of my lizard brain. And so that's part of what happened. And another part of what happened, and we can talk about this perhaps a bit later, is the point of me. I started writing this book when I was on the cusp of 40. And that's also relevant for the adult aspects of Evan, though we're still in his and evidently my childhood.
Yeah. No, I want to talk about it now. Why, John, okay. we're getting into okay. the
can
flow.
Can I get a bourbon?
Now you can get a vodka. Okay. They've got a very well-stocked bar out there.
So,
but you, because this is life going in tranches, really, isn't
that's
it?
That's right. Yeah, I so mean, so the other...
40.
Well, the other thing for me, so I'm now on the cusp of 50, but when I started this book, I was on the cusp of 40, and what I didn't realize that was coming out of my writing, really, was that was at an age where I think I was starting to think about all the skills and rules, the Assassin's Ten Commandments that had governed me from the time that I made that choice. So I made a vow. We can go back. Are we going to get autobiographical? Should we do that?
We can do a bit. We've got a bit of time.
Here, so when I was a freshman at this high school, amazing, amazing high school that I grew to love, I couldn't do anything. And my high school had been around a year before California was a state. It's a kind of a historic high school, yeah, which is like 10 years to you people. But, you know, in America, for California, that's old. And the longest standing sports record was the pole vault record. And so I set that as the goal for myself to have some any sense of like worth and accruing of social status or power was that I was going to break that by my senior year. And so I kind of locked in terms of discipline, maximizing my time, everything. And that's those skills carried me very, very well, right, through a lot of aspects of my life. Now, middle of life for me, and don't worry, you'll all get there someday, it's a time where I think I was looking around and thinking that a lot of the rules that had governed my life weren't necessarily going to be applicable to the rules that I wanted to govern what I hoped to be the second half of my life. But what makes it hard is the things that are obviously destructive are easier, if not to outgrow, because we all have those streaks that we're always trying to root out, but at least to identify as things that you don't want. But what was very interesting to me around that age was I realized that a lot of the things that had been survival skills that had served me well and had given me my life and my family, which I love, and my career, which I love, that those are the ones that are harder to let go of. And sometimes that's what sacrifice is really about, right? You don't sacrifice, like, why do you sacrifice a fat calf in a time of drought? It's the least logical thing, right? But ostensibly, if you're in a period of drought, you have to give up the thing that you think is the most meaningful to you to make way for the new. And so I think I was in a bit of that process. And of course, looking back, because hindsight is 2020, that's a lot of what's happening, because we don't meet Evan in Orphan X when he's a kid or when he's Orphan X or when he's operating. We meet him all the way through the program, all the way through the process when he's reestablished himself as the Nowhere Man. And in the first book, he breaks all 10 of the Assassin's Commandments that he was raised with. And he's breaking through an older version of himself, right, in that quest to learn what it means to be a human being and what it means to live among other people.
Can I just clarify the Assassin's Commandments? Because I've just put in the chat for those that are joining us online, the 10 Commandments. Are they Evan's Commandments or the Assassin's Commandments?
Well, they're handed.
It starts with assume nothing.
Assume nothing is the first one. The second one, which is the most quoted and occasionally tattooed, is how you do anything is how you do everything. That one's really taken hold.
Yeah. Let's start with the first one, because, I mean, you paint a picture there of your childhood, in a way, of going to this very strange school where you have to prove yourself in something. You feel insecure until you've actually got up there. And I know I mentioned the word vulnerable, but you began with it, Greg, so that was the word vulnerable. So the assume nothing is really a situational awareness, is it? To keep yourself safe.
In a lot of ways. It's interesting because in Zen, it's beginner's mind, right? Okay. Like monks who meditate, when the chime rings to end the meditation, every time their brain activity, if they're really skilled in it, is alarming, like it's the first time they've ever heard it. And operationally, that's part of what you want to do too. So for Evan, he can't go rote. Like basically when we exist, when we move through the world, most of what we're doing is not noticing the vast majority of things that come into us, right? Because I think our visual cortex receives 10 or 20,000 pieces of information. So we track movement, right? We tend to track movement that's low because we're, you know, tree dwelling primates who are terrified of snakes. A lot of what we're doing is blocking out the rush of stimuli that are coming in. And if you can't block that out, that places you in a different place on a spectrum. And part of it when you're operating is you don't want to block things out. You need to see if that door latch is slightly off kilter from where you left it, right? You need to see if...
You need to take in everything.
You need to take everything in as if for the first time.
And be aware where the dangers are and where the avenues out are.
And I mean, I'm sure all of you have had the experience of where you walk home or you ride the tube or you drive and you barely remember it, right? You're lost in your thoughts. You couldn't say what car you were in front of or who sat next to you on the tube or, right? We're in our own thoughts. He can't afford that. Any of those things will get him killed.
Yeah. I just want to go, we're getting some comments in here. Lillette Butler, read Orphan X and the list, excellent books. There you go.
Thank you.
One virtual fan that we have here.
Thank you, Mom.
Gita has her commandment, treat others as you would like to be treated. Mm-hmm. Yes, I did. And writing from your gut, she says, will make you a great author. So real. There you go. That's... and we have reactions to Gita's thing about writing from your gut and treat others as you would like to be treated. Mm. That's not on this list that I've got here. But
Evan does not treat people how he wants to be treated.
No, he's not.
Yeah, he doesn't want to be garroted in a banya.
Yeah, he's a different, and the most famous one, you say that's tattooed, how you do anything is how you do everything. So how you're doing this interview is how you're doing everything.
Well, it's so much of what we're all trying to do, I think, is we're trying to align to be in the world in a way that we feel present and alive. Like that's the aim of much of what we do. And so there's no end to how many times and ways you can try to do that. Of course, we're going to fail in that because we're not all the Dalai Lama. But if you try to move towards excellence in every aspect or connection or presence, you know, then there's opportunities abound which you wouldn't otherwise see. And even when there's the necessary and inevitable shortcuts or not shortcuts, but let's say pain, you can at least try and diminish your share of suffering in it. But, you know, that doesn't happen. We tend to get, you know, whiny or knocked down or... And so it's a process of continuously trying to reorient that. But you can also see, I mentioned that Evan has a OCD kind of gets him in its grip now and then. And you can see that OCD is very much that second commandment gone out of control. Like there's an aspect where you can strive to excellence and then you can get stuck and loop in compulsive thoughts around that.
That's the idea of the perfectionist, which in fact, I think has now been diagnosed as an OCD thing. If you become too much perfectionist. You're in fact not a perfectionist because we can never get everything right.
Well, and of course, the don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and he's much more interested in, as an operator, as an assassin, he doesn't care about the good. He cares about the perfect. And yet he's somebody who was trained to not let go of the good inside him. Mm-hmm. And so that essential internal friction for me as an author is endlessly yielding. It's why I'm 8 books in and, delighting as I work on the 9th. It gives me a lot of texture. It's not just about plot. Everything has to be about character. If you stop someone on the street and you say, what's your favorite action scene from a James Bond movie? They might hesitate, but we all know how he takes his martini, right? So character is gotta be the essential aspect of everything.
Yes.
I don't just wanna write fight scenes. We've all been to those movies that you just feel like you're getting punched in the face with action, right? For that never ending third act at the end of a movie where it's kind of like action fatigue. Everything has to come back to character and derive from character. And so the process for me of writing a series and being, I have to be engaged. If I'm not engaged with this character in a way that's genuine, then I can't expect readers to be.
And how do you're 8 books in, the first portrayal that you gave us of Orphan X in the first book, how does that develop layer by layer until you get to now? How do you get your reader to know, love, and want more of the character?
A lot of it is when I was younger in my career, I thought about writing in terms of heroes and villains. And the further along I get, I think about writing protagonists and antagonists. So I used to think that if I write about my character, that he's great and he's the best of the best and he's up against somebody who's a, incomprehensible madman, that somehow like the worse the villain is, the better that will accrue to the hero. And as I progress, as Evan progresses out of Black and White into more than 50 Shades of Grey, part of that process is, where are his flaws? Where are his shortcomings? Those are the things that help us connect with somebody. It's all about him mishandling something, misreading some personal situation that he didn't know, and then feeling, shame or regret or embarrassment over it, or navigating something the wrong way.
Give us an example. Give us one.
Like he'll get
one of the books.
So Joey Morales, Josephine Morales, is his 16-year-old hacker who he is tasked with. He's very much a lone wolf in the first 2 books, and then is sort of stuck with her on a mission when she's the last thing he wants. She's a brilliant, brilliant hacker, and she's a washout from the orphan program, and he's tasked. She kind of becomes his charge. But at times with her, she's very brilliant and very tough and very vulnerable. And he'll just snap into mode and like dismiss her. Like he can just take her off at the knees if he's in an operational mode and not thinking about her as a sentient human being with feelings, right? And so when that happens, if he comes at her too hard, she'll be devastated and he doesn't have the processing to think it through emotionally from her perspective necessarily. And those are actually the moments that we connect characters, because we're not all the best of the best. At least I'm certainly not, right? I'm like, the cracks are where the light comes through. And so having him be in a situation where he's trying to do his best against odds from a very difficult background, right? Or very complicated background, and falling short and aware of that, aware of all the ways that he might lack courage in certain ways that matter deeply, like when it comes about to intimate relationships, it causes us to lean in. And I think likewise too, when the antagonists are more compelling. I always want my antagonist to like whisper to your Jungian shadow. Like they have to make a really good argument where you're on the verge of going with them and the things that they think. And that's really accelerated as Evan has evolved more. The complexity of the characters he has to be up against becomes more and more.
And the characters that he's up against, are they unequivocally bad?
No.
Or how, and what does the, how do you, how do I phrase this? I mean, I'm thinking of a Clint Eastwood movie where he goes in, he shoots up the bad guys and rides off into the sunset. Mm. And the people that he shoots up are unequivocally bad. Does that work in the thriller? Or do you need to give your bad people some humanity that we understand why they're doing what they're doing?
Well, I bring more and more to that as well. I mean, those movies, it's like, you look at a Charles Bronson action movie from the 80s, and it's like, it's like if you're ethnic and riding the subway, you're a bad guy, right? Like it's just like there's these clear divisions of how we sort of delineate. And, I started from a place of writing bad guys, right? Early in my career, I started quite young, and I was fortunate to have some luck when I was younger, which is wonderful. I mean, I started my first book, I was 19. Mm. You know, the flip side is no one should ever be held accountable for anything that they thought when they're 19, you know, particularly when you're in indelible
ink. Is it still in print?
It is, yeah. But, you know, and so, but more and more for me, I want the antagonist to really challenge and threaten Evan in different ways and make him think about himself in different ways. Because it's not just about the mission. If it's about the mission, right, I could put that into, you know, an AI program and spit out the next adventure. It's about the fact that the mission that he's undertaking that's external, right? There's something inside him that he's up against, right? That he has to, it's going to put keys in locks that he doesn't want to open.
I want you to describe to us where he lives and how he looks out on society, given that he was taken out of society as an orphan, dehumanized, as you say, and then has to go back in again. Can you give us that?
So Evan hides in plain sight. He lives in a penthouse apartment. It's 7,000 square feet of just Scandinavian design. It's poured concrete and stainless steel surfaces in a residential tower in Los Angeles. And part of what it is I mentioned that he kind of has his face up to the aquarium glass and the real world is on the other side of it. He can look out his window and he has this like dollhouse view into other people. Leading other, like there's a, you know, an older couple practicing waltz and there's a father teaching his diapered toddler to walk, right? And there's a couple having dinner together. So he's always this kind of voyeur and observer to that. And one of the things that I wanted to do with the series, and it's another thing that I believe distinguishes Orphan X from other characters is, you know, we never get to see Jason Bourne go home. Right. But I have this archetypal character in Evan where he'll go get in a knife fight, but then he'll come back and get like strong armed into the homeowners association meeting where there's a contentious debate about choosing the color of the carpet for the lobby. And he's like bleeding out from a knife wound and he's getting harangued by, you know, the elderly Jewish neighbor who lives downstairs, who's mad at him that his truck leaked oil because she doesn't know it was just shot up. And so he's constantly having this like bracing reentry into the real world. And that toggling between the two, you know, I've written a character who's perfectly at home, you know, calculating the wind drift on a sniper round to assassinate a head of a cartel member. But if he's forced to make small talk at the mail slots, he's just undone. He just doesn't even know where to begin with it. And so that's a lot of the fun in it, because I think no matter who we are and where we start, like we all have places that we struggle to fit in or where there's imposter syndrome or places that we've been in our lives where we feel like we just don't know the code. We just don't have the language for that. I think that's something people can really relate to.
You're not having that now, are you? You feel at home here, do you?
It depends. If we go further into my childhood, I'm going to have to lay down on a couch.
We have a question from Geeta Gargan. Thank you for your contributions, Geeta. Do you plot out all the chapters first or does your writing develop itself more organically?
I work in an odd combination of both. I have what I call a rolling outline, which is I have I'll start with about 20 pages of bullet points, roughly grouped into dialogue, scenes, character stuff. And that's the clay. That's the rough matter. And I usually know the first three or four chapters when I start. But that outline, I have a big fat monitor that's like a TV screen. And I have the two documents up side by side. So I have the novel here. I have the outline over here. And as I'm writing, I'm always looking for opportunities and I'm always discovering things. So that outline lives and breathes and grows. It tends to bloat first. It gets up to 25 pages. It goes to 26 pages as I'm writing because I keep thinking, oh, I'm going to drop a handkerchief here and then I'm going to revisit it here and then I'm going to pay it off at the third act. And so it's sort of this dance. And then at a certain point, the outline finally begins to contract. And when I'm done with the book, I have a 400-page manuscript here and then I have empty document here because I've absorbed it into the book.
Moving them across. So that's, I hope that answers your question, Geeta. But she also asks, and I was about to ask you, what was your book called, which you wrote when you were 19? And is it on sale outside?
Oh, no. It's not on sale. It's called The Tower. It's very young.
The Tower. Okay. If anybody loves it, buy this, love it, and then order The Tower from Nomad Books that are selling Greg's books outside. And last one from Geeta. I think we've answered what aspects of Evan are yours, Greg. Give us a one line on that.
What was that?
What aspects of Evan are yours? Only one line. Well, we can't go. I did promise we wouldn't go too far.
All writers write about themselves.
Okay.
That's what I'll say.
Okay, so, there's another one here. Why did your parents send you to a Catholic Jesuit school since they were of the Jewish faith?
Well, so I was in a town, I was in Silicon Valley before it diversified. So it was like, it was a lot of like these like white engineers, guys with horn rimmed glasses. They look like a NASA launch, right? Like all the, and so it was like, it was Hewlett Packard. It was early days. And we were like one of the only Jewish families in my whole town. There was like one Black family and one Jewish family. And so it's not like me going to my high school was going to be somehow, you know, in this embrace. And we were fairly secular. I had a pretty secular upbringing. My parents are from the East Coast, kind of intellectual. And one of the things that happened was the public school I was supposed to go to back then was taking on some affluence, not like now. I mean, Silicon Valley now is ridiculous, right? It's like, it's the largest accumulation of wealth in the history of mankind.
It's kind of an airport, hasn't it? It was San Jose. I mean,
yeah,
30 miles from San Francisco.
But so it wasn't there, but it was like if people were starting high school, they got a new Mustang, right? Not a new BMW. Yeah. And they just didn't like the kind of ethic that was happening there. And so it's really interesting. So they sent me to this other school. It's called Bellarmine College Prep. It was in San Jose, back when San Jose was still San Jose. I mean, now it's gentrified significantly. Gentrified is the wrong word. A lot of money has come in and more of the arts has come in. But it was, and at the time, it was the most ethnically and economically diverse high school in California, I want to say. Okay. There was all sorts of different groups.
Was it actually a boarding school or a day school?
No, it was a day school. It used to be a boarding school.
Yeah.
But like there was more Jewish students there than there would have been at the high school, the public high school I was supposed to go to. But there was also Hispanic students and there was a Black student union. And then there was, you know, a lot of Irish Catholics. It was a big blend, but they were very much about building character. And Jesuits are amazing. You know, Jesuits are in some ways, they're like the liberals of the church, you know, they're very, they really know how to educate properly. Yeah. And so it was, I went kicking and screaming and hated it my first year. And then it was life altering for me in a way that was positive.
Okay, I've got to say, I've visited the Jesuits in the most far flung places in the world, in the sort of the Philippines and Asia and that sort of thing. And when there's no education there at all, they are there. And I think they send, if you are sent out as a Jesuit priest to a place like, you stay for life. It's not like a 3-year posting. That is where you are going to live for the rest of your life.
Yeah, it's a wonderful tradition.
I want to touch on a couple more of these commandments. And we have got silence from the live audience. So ask us a question, challenge what Greg has said, because you have a commandment here, never kill a kid. All right, to kill everybody else.
Can we agree on that, Vera? Is that the one you're going to challenge me on?
I don't know.
Also, always question orders.
Yes, number 6 is question orders. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Like I said, Jack didn't raise Evan to be a true believer, and that's part of what led to the unraveling of the world as he knew it, right? Because if you, he said, you know, on the one hand, one of the things that usually a soldier or a government operative is told is to just, you follow orders no matter what.
Yes.
And Jack was like, always question orders, right?
Yeah.
Like make sure that what you're doing isn't going to be something that is misaligned with your humanity in a fundamental way.
And I like number 5, if you don't know what to do, do nothing.
That's his and my least favorite commandment. That's a hard one to stick to. But
it is sensible, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do well to obey that one much more often.
Yeah. Is there we had the one came in, I think it was from Gita but there are these sort of
rats. I love this Gita. She's like a very active interlocutor.
Yeah. Gita, you are loved, Gita. And she's got some more questions for you that I'm going to save till the end. And we have some from here, but is there a rap one? Is it treat others like yourself? Does Evan have a sort of one sentence value commandment that he sticks with?
But that's not one of the commandments, no.
That's
but
not,
Jack does tell him at one point, like, if you don't have value, then nobody does.
Okay.
Because when he's out of the foster home and Jack's pushing him, Jack pushes him to read philosophy and military history. He's reading Art of War, Sun Tzu. He's reading German military history. And at some point, Evan's like, how am I supposed to know all this? I'm just like, I'm a dumb foster kid. And Jack, like, it's the one time Jack gets really angry at him.
If you don't have values, so what it is know your values and live by them.
Well, or know that you have value. Yes. If you're going to act as if you don't have value, then nobody else does.
Yeah.
Like, so in a way, it's almost an act of arrogance. Yes.
We have here unsigned, so you can stay anonymous or you can put up a hand and ask it yourself. Now, I can't see one, but then it's a glare here. We hear about method actors, but it sounds like you're a method author. Does that make you unusual?
I hope so.
Are you a method author?
Well, it is important for me to make sure that I'm getting in and getting the real story. It's interesting that term is funny, because I think there is part of it that if I embody it, then I can write about it differently. And one of the things that's a challenge is, you know, with research, you think of research as it's the glacier, right, that's beneath the ocean. But, well, it's an iceberg, right? But all that makes it into the story is the tip of the iceberg. But you kind of have to know the whole iceberg to know where the tip is. And there's a phrase, somebody else said this, and I can't remember who. I think it was recounted to me by Laura Lippman. So it's either her line or something she was recounting, that somebody had too much research in a book. Because when you do a lot of research, sometimes they're tempted to put it in so everyone can know how clever you are. And she said that somebody had once said something like, oh, your research slip is showing, right? You always have to be, you know, you always have to make sure that you're not imposing yourself as the author on the story. The story is paramount.
Yeah.
Story always has to be paramount.
We have, so Angie has written this, a couple of points here. How would you evict Evan when the time comes? He's inhabited you for many years. How tricky will it be, or will he be evicted?
Yeah, not right now. He's not evicting anytime soon. So, yeah. It's going to be interesting. People ask that a lot. How are you going to end the series? Yeah. But, you know, I spend more waking hours with Evan than I do with my family.
Yeah. And you don't have to end. I mean, he's at the top of his game at the moment.
He's doing fine. Yeah. What are we trying to evict him for? Yes. Come on, people. Let's cut him some slack.
Yes. All right.
Well, he's not like long in the tooth.
Oh, I can see there's a hand there. You are. Yeah, you're in his sights, because Angie's next question is, you know, a lot of former special ops operatives. Is there something you're not telling us? But tell us a story from your research. Tell us how you've been on something that's incredible and has moved into
My second book is a medical thriller. I'm from a family of doctors. And the only time I could interview one hospital tech was while he was literally carving up a cadaver. He was parting it out for different departments. So he had a Sawzall blade, and I'm there interviewing him, wishing that I'd worn like galoshes. And I was asking him questions. And so, you know, he cuts the head off and the head goes to neurology and the joints go to the orthopods. And right. So he's kind of carving up in somewhat flamboyant fashion this corpse. And he finishes. And it was pretty compelling watching it. And he goes across and there's two giant steel doors. Giant. And he cranks one open and a gust of mist comes out. And it's a giant freezer unit. And inside are two dozen corpses, suspended from their heads, from their ears, with figure eight scissor clamps so that their feet are dangling like this above the ground. Now, the reason that cadavers are stored that way in some medical facilities is if you store them flat, the bodies distort, and that makes it more difficult for med students dealing with anatomy. And he took one by the arm and dragged it on a chain like a meat hook across the ceiling and lowered it down and began working on that body. And I thought this was one of the most spectacularly cool things I'd ever seen. And I had a scene in the book where my character is like running through the hospital at night. It's an abandoned part of the hospital and he needs to hide somewhere. And I thought, what a perfect setting, right? And one of the things I learned with that is that the point of research is not to go fill in the blanks. It's not to paint by numbers. It's not to color in what I know. It's to go out and be open to opportunities that present themselves. And so that was a very interesting lesson for me, which was that's also part of what happens when I put myself there, as I see and encounter things that I might otherwise not.
And when you do some of your research with special forces people and you say you're on the cusp of 50, when you're in there doing the training with them, what do you learn? What's it like? Because they're going to be 20 years younger.
I learn what it is like to be on the cusp of 50.
And again, you know, when you see, you know, a Jack Ryan movie or a James Bond movie and all these sort of things like that, do you say, oh, well, actually, it doesn't happen like that. This is actually how it happens when I'm with these guys. This is how they talk, how they think, that they have humanity that you don't see.
Yeah, I mean, look, I always want to capture part of the point of spending time with people. Like, I don't really go to my friends who are operatives or former operatives now that often with questions. It's more like genuine friendships have developed and I'm getting an ear for how they see the world, right? Mm-hmm. So I grew up from a family of physicians, as I mentioned, my dad's a doctor. I remember we'd be out at dinner and if the waiter came over and had a shuffle step, if it was a waiter of a certain age, my dad would say, oh, that's probably polio, right? Like he thinks and perceives the world like a doctor. He has a very diagnostic eye. And so when you're writing characters and when you're researching, the main thing you're trying to do is to kind of pull on the mask of the character and see the world through their eye holes. You want to know what their perspective is and how they see things. And so a lot of that time that I spend with operators who are like that is hearing, like, where do they sit? Where do their eyes go to? What are they paying attention to? How do they talk? Mm. Right? Where's their focus? The most powerful thing we have, we're talking about this earlier, is where we put our focus, where we put our attention. And people from different professions put it in different places. And so Evan has a very different set of things that he's paying attention to when he walks in a room than you or I do.
Which partly brings me on to the thing I want to cover quite quickly before we run out of time, is that outside of your day job, which you actually described as quite boring because you just go in and write all day and come out again.
I mean, it's not boring for me.
It's not boring for you.
No one needs to observe it.
Quite.
Yeah.
But you get people together. You know, our politics is very polarized at the moment. We've had it here. It's over in the States. You get people together to try to understand each other's points of view. Mm-hmm. How do you do that? Who have you got together? And is it successful?
Well, you know, part of this is back to the first commandment, which is assume nothing. Mm. You know, so I've done a lot of work in the political sphere. I've done things like, you know, went to D.C. and took 10 Democratic Congress members of Congress and 10 Republicans and sat them down and had a meal and broke bread and had conversations about trying to find commonalities, right? So one of the things that you find, you know, in a polarizing environment and one that is polarized, every single force that is up against us right now, in what my colleague who I work with some unity building, her name is Samar Ali, she calls the hate industrial complex, right? Which is... Yeah. How do we get you stuck on your phone? How do we get you stuck to the news? How do I fundraise with you? It's like fear, right? You want fear. You want dopamine hits. You want outrage. You want, and that's being tracked. It's being tracked algorithmically. Like when you're scrolling through your phone, you know, let's say you're on Twitter and you hitch with your thumb and look at one thing slightly longer, they know where you're hitching. And so, you know, some of these companies have teams of addiction specialists, right? Powered by deep machine learning algorithms to make sure and ensure that your nervous system is being hijacked, right? To be stuck into something. And you don't get there with stories of unity or peace building or, hey, maybe the other side isn't a fearsome monolith, right? You only get that through having difficult movement across the aisle. And a lot of times when I move across the aisle, I feel like as I'm going there, I'm taking arrows in the back. Mm. And I mean across the aisle anywhere. I don't have one aisle, mm-hmm. right? I move through a lot of different subsets and different communities.
But you say you get people from two opposite things, but the clickbait, hate clickbait that you just described, that is now an intrinsic part of our democratic process, isn't it?
Well, not so democratic, but yes.
Well, but I was going to say a politician, in order to get elected,
right,
has to feature on that, and his voters are going to see where he stands on an issue.
Unless they can envision, instead of generating the same cross tension, right? Yes. We need an enemy. I need to fundraise. I need to terrify you. Yeah. Yeah. If they can lift their gaze to a more transcendental value set, not always, but
have you had success in that?
Yeah. And there are some good people who are doing that. But look, it's tricky. I mean, there's a lot of forces that are arrayed against us viewing and conceding that the other side isn't merely a dehumanized monolith seeking to unstitch the fabric of society in the world as we know it. And it's dizzying for me sometimes moving between extremes.
So if you were arranging a meeting between Vladimir Putin and President Biden in a room, how would you get them to see some common ground, do you think?
Given the current state and tensions of that particular situation, I feel that I don't want to give a glib answer. So anything that I say is going to sound too glib.
Yeah.
But I will say this, like one of the things that we tack to is, do you know, and perhaps you're familiar with big five personality traits or big five personality theory. It's better known often by the Myers-Briggs test that tells you you're extroverted or introverted. Well, big five personality traits, however you think that they arrive, whether you believe they're God-given or evolutionarily selected, they're a bell curve distribution across all races, ethnicities, you know, men and women, there's some differences, but they're not differentiated. And so your big five, the value structure that you have, the kind of order of hierarchy that you have in your big five traits is one of the largest predictors for which way your political leanings will be. And these are traits that are intrinsic to us. So high trait openness, right? How open are you to new experiences? That's a big predictor for liberalism. Of course, that's cities, that's entertainment. Do you live in a city? Do you like people of different races? Do you like different foods? Do you like different accents? Are you open to more experiences? That doesn't mean that it doesn't matter if you're black or brown or white or green, right? It's just there's a subset and a bell curve for that. And if you're lower trait openness, you tend to be more conservative. You like walls around things. You like borders around countries. You like definitions around gender. And one of the things that we seem to have forgotten is that, and by the way, when I say liberals and conservatives, I'm not talking about political parties. The political parties in a lot of regards have come unhooked from these definitions. So I'm talking just about our traits and proclivities as human beings. But we tend to forget that the best way that a society navigates itself is with good faith embodiments of both liberal and conservative values. The liberals are the gas, right? And the conservatives are the brakes. And if you're in a car and you're just stomping on the gas, you're going to smash into a wall or go off a cliff. And if you're just standing on the brake, you don't go anywhere, nothing gets done. Yeah. And so there has to be an exchange between these value sets that's given voice to. So conservatives will say, build a wall, right? That's a great conservative slogan, right? We want a wall. We want to keep outsiders out. We need some in-group definition. Well, you can understand why that makes sense from an evolutionary perspective. If you're Native Americans and European settlers are showing up offering you blankets filled with smallpox, it makes sense to hold your distance and have some concern about contamination. But if that wall that you're building around countries, around gender becomes rigid, if it's not porous, then new ideas and people can't come in and we stagnate and we die. And so there's a balance in navigating complex change between these different personality trait structures, which we can't change. You can't be liberal and just educate someone into a higher state of empathy and openness any more than you could go up to Tony Blair and demand that he become an introvert. It's not how people are wired. And we know this if we think for like 30 seconds, right? Yeah. If you have a kid, you know, who has a trait that you don't like or that doesn't fit yours, and you just lean on them and shame them and degrade them for having that trait, things don't go well. Things will probably get oppositional. Things will probably get polarized. They'll probably start to do the opposite of what it is that you're leaning on them to do.
I want everyone to hold those really good thoughts. Of all the press we've had about that, that was one of the best explanations I found about liberalism and conservatism. But I have to tell everybody what's coming up next on a Golster, and then back to you for our final minutes tomorrow, Friday, February the 10th. I'm with Andrew Harding. That's BBC's Africa correspondent, recently Ukraine war correspondent. And he has written an incredible non-fiction page turner called These Are Not Gentle People, about murder in a small African community. Think of Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, meeting Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, and set it in the 21st century in racially torn South Africa. And you have got a brilliant book there that we're going to be discussing tomorrow. February the 16th, I'm with Christina and Ryan Hillsberg, Licensed to Parent, How My Career as a Spy Helped Me Raise Resourceful, Self-Sufficient Kids. It is hilarious. Christina thinks James Bond was a dreadful spy, and don't even get her on the Bond girls. So that's coming up February the 17th. I think that is the next time with Bob Gourlay, The Cyber Threat, Know the Threat to Beat the Threat. That's about how we keep our banking safe and our phones safe and everything like that. And then the 23rd, Lucinda is with the marvelous Marika Cobbold, who's just published her eighth novel, On Hampstead Heath, which tells the story of Thorn Marsh, who was raised in a house of whispers, of meaningful glances and half-finished sentences. Sounds like there should be one of the Ten Commandments attached to that, Greg.
It sounds like quite a lineup.
Yeah,
it sounds amazing.
This is our goal.
Kill a Mockingbird meets In Cold Blood. I'm going to steal that from an Orphan X book.
That's a good one. A very quick question that I would... can you explain? You've got 2 seconds to do this. This is from Emma. Can you explain the ninth commandment, always play offense?
You know, the best defense is a good offense, right, as we know. And part of this is quite often... speaking of, we're coming out of a political cultural conversation, yeah. But the unknown holds equal parts threat and opportunity.
Yeah.
Right. And if we recoil, if we're playing defense, we don't often get, we don't often move forward. And in fact, consensual engagement with the unknown is the path to growth. Yeah. Right. And that tends to be offense.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. You can't just hole up. If you hole up from your fears, right, they grow bigger and they
That's
come
just
devour.
Conservative
you.
Liberalism thing again, in a way, isn't
That's
it?
Right.
Getting this balance between moving forward and keeping safe and holding back. And a final thought from you, Greg, because Golster encourages people over 50, which are just about to come, to stay active, keep curious, keep involved. Get out of bed in the morning with a spring in their step. How does what you do, the fiction writing, and what advice do you give to people to stay active and happy?
I think the biggest thing is you have to find the thing. If you pay attention, you'll what is of interest? What flare can flame into a bigger fire will present itself to you. And I think that one of the steps that we fall into is what you should do. I should get up. I should do yoga. I should read books, like where you're dragging along into trying to kind of generate new interests. And that tends to place a lot of pressure on oneself, right? Versus if you wait and you really think about something that you love, whether it's Hitchcock movies or a kind of reading, or maybe it's walking, or maybe it's golf, or you don't know what the thing is, but give yourself latitude to explore a whole bunch of things and be aware that as you explore them, you inevitably will be terrible at them when you start.
Like you in the martial arts.
Thank you. Thank you for that. We weren't talking about me just now, Humphrey.
No, and you were younger, yes, but...
Yes, like me, there are me writing my first novel. I mean, there's no way to write a novel without doing it and screwing it up. Yeah. I mean, literally when I was writing my rough draft when I was 19, the end of every chapter was better than the beginning from what I'd learned writing the chapter. And so I'd say, pay attention to where there's flares of genuine interest rather than like shoving yourself into activities that you're supposed to be doing, and you'll find them. And if you find them, you want to nourish them.
Find them and nourish them. Thank you so much. Time's winged chariot is upon us. And thank you all for being with us in person. And thank you for being with us virtually. And for those who will be with us in the future on the Golster podcast, catch up and the rest of those wonderful technical platforms. Thank you, Greg Hurwitz, for coming all the way to Riverstone on the banks of the Thames to share your actually incredibly moving, uplifting, really insightful thoughts on how to write, how to live, how to keep a moral compass. I mean, fantastic stuff. And for everyone, until next time, as Greg said, stay active, stay curious, stay passionate, stay involved, and of course, stay Golster. And thank you, Greg. What a great conversation we've had. Let's give him a huge round of applause.
Thank you.
And outside, Nomad Books is waiting. So if you just file out, Greg will be sitting there. He will sign the book for you. Have a chat to him. Don't ask him too many vulnerable questions. And then he will sign it. And then there's a lunch and all sorts of things going on. But thanks so much, Greg.
Thank you so much.
Cheers. Thank you for listening. And find out our vast range on www.golster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Goldster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us at Goldster.